Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. I'm John Tanza on this live broadcast from Washington. Here are some of the top stories making news across Sudan and South Sudan this Tuesday, June 6, 2023. A former member of Sudan's Sovereign Council says civilians trapped inside Khartoum are going through tough time.
Unfortunately, we have seen here increasing of the level of the violation. This time, it is not only in Khartoum, but outside Khartoum.
And South Sudan's Justice Minister says the work on the country's constitution should not be rushed.
And there are so many stakeholders who are supposed to be actors in the implementation. These people got to be given room to play their role.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Heavy fighting has resumed in Sudan's capital, Khartoum. The violence follows expiration of the ceasefire on Saturday negotiated by the Saudi Arabia and the United States. Mohamed Al-Taashi is a former member of Sudan's Transitional Sovereign Council. He tells Daybreak Africa host James Batty that fighting is spreading to Darfur and Kordofan states, adding that the humanitarian situation in Khartoum is getting worse.
Unfortunately, we have seen here increasing of the level of the violation. This time, it is not only in Khartoum, but outside Khartoum. We've seen a level of a violation in Darfur for many areas, and not the least, at Jenina, Al-Fashir, and Khartoum, and somewhere else. The needs of the ceasefire here in Sudan, it is not only about decreasing the violation. It is for humanitarian issues. The Sudanese people's life is completely stopped. We cannot imagine the life of the Sudanese people without any truce in the coming days. So yes, without a ceasefire agreement, there is no way for the conflict to be decreased.
Last Friday, the UN Security Council renewed the mandate or the mission of the United Nations mission in Sudan. Do you think it will make a difference?
Obviously, I think it's a good idea for the Security Council to come up with this strong consensus about the Sudanese mission. We do need national mission in Sudan to help the Sudanese people. There is many challenges is facing workers. There is many challenges facing international community. First, we do need to stop this conflict. That's the only way we can allow the transitional process to accomplish. So I think it's very important for the international community to support the mission and for the Sudanese actors to work closely with the mission as well to establish a civilian government very soon.
Did I read somewhere that General Burhan has said that the military no longer wants the UN representative in Sudan? How true is that?
Yes, General Burhan declared its position thus against the representatives of the mission. But basically, the actual position of Burhan reflected the position of the military in general. And this is not something new. We all know the story when the delays been in place to stop Hamdok, the prime minister of the transitional government by then, not to process the mission and at that time. So I think Burhan's position now reflected the actual position, not only for him, but for the military in general.
That's Mohamed Taashi, former member of Sudan's Transitional Sovereign Council. He was speaking to Daybreak Africa host James Batty earlier today from Khartoum. The UN Security Council called for an immediate ceasefire in Sudan to be followed by a permanent halt to hostilities and fresh efforts to reach a lasting democratic political settlement. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said the Biden administration remains committed to ensuring peace prevails in Sudan. Amri Hamzawi is the director of Koinagi Middle East Program. He told VOA's senior analyst Muhammad Al-Ashanawi that there are two layers behind the conflict in Sudan.
The first one is historically older than recent tensions, older than the democratic uprising in 2018, which launched at least an attempt to create democratic governance in Sudan. The first layer is centered around tensions between central government in Khartoum, its ruling establishment, its elite, no matter we're referring to civilian forces or military security forces, on the one hand, and on the other hand, different regions which are populated by non-Arabs ethnically, majority-wise, and which are populated by non-Muslims in terms of their religious affiliation. These tensions have, in fact, dominated Sudan's political development since the 1950s, since Sudan's independence, early 50s. The second layer, which is more related to the current environment, is the fact that Sudan, and it's a residual of former President Omar al-Bashir's policies and practices, Sudan has been suffering from a duality in the armed forces. An army, a professional army, has existed for a long time alongside paramilitary troops. So what's happening right now is a convergence of these two layers, leading to civil war-like situations, not only in Khartoum and Umm Durman, but even in remote regions. And it's a scramble for influence, for representation, for social and economic gains. And therefore, ceasefire arrangements and agreements are not kicking in up until now.
U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan announced U.S. economic sanctions on Sudan's warring generals. What else could convince the two sides to agree to a ceasefire and to start negotiations to settle the conflict in Sudan?
As long as each side believes that it could deal the opposing side a military defeat, the war will not stop and military operations will not stop. It's only when they come to realize that they cannot deal their adversaries a decisive military defeat, that they would start taking negotiating tables and negotiations more seriously in the sense of agreeing to binding arrangements and binding stipulations. But as we know from different civil war situations, even previous ones in Sudan, Sudan lived in a civil war between its government in the north and the south for over four decades until the Republic of South Sudan was created in end of 2011, beginning of 2012. Civil wars have an intrinsic logic into them. They perpetuate themselves by creating new elites, by creating new groups which are benefiting, new beneficiaries socially, economically, and politically, and their scramble and strive toward ultimate power continues as long as they do not realize that they cannot defeat their adversaries decisively in the battlefield. Unfortunately, the battlefield will continue.
That's Amri Hamzawi, director of Koinagi Middle East Program. He spoke with VOA's senior analyst Muhammad Al-Ashanawi. Still on Sudan, Motema is a town linking Ethiopia with Sudan. Since April, when the Sudanese army and the paramilitary rapid support forces began fighting in Khartoum, thousands have flocked to this town. The International Organization for Migration is on the ground assisting the refugees. Habibetua Wainfall is the chief of IOM mission in Ethiopia. He spoke to Yehia Swihub on the situation in Motema.
Motema is a town linking Ethiopia with Sudan since April 15th, when the Sudanese army and the paramilitary rapid support forces clashed in Khartoum. Thousands have been flocking to this town. The International Organization for Migration, IOM, is on the ground assisting the displaced. Abibatu Wainfall is chief of mission for IOM Ethiopian office. She was in Motema recently and says she was surprised at how the peaceful border town all of a sudden became very congested.
Yes, thank you. As you mentioned, I was in Metemma last week, so which is in Amara and after Gondar. So yes, one of the main observations that I've noticed is really how crowded towards Metemma. Metemma is at the entry point between Ethiopia and Sudan, and there are many arrivals and many people scattered across the border, including mothers, children, sitting under 40 degrees Celsius heat, and some days are even hotter. And it is not really sustainable, not healthy to live like this.
Abibatu says the situation in the border town of Metemma is really alarming. Despite the hurdles, her organization and fellow partners, she says, are working diligently to provide assistance, setting up temporary accommodations and health services.
For instance, IAM and partners have been working to provide assistance. We have excellent wash facilities there, but clearly there are so many people that the facilities cannot really, are not adequate really to provide or to accommodate the needs of these people that are there because of the high number. So this means that really the large numbers of new arrivals has become a real major challenge for us. And there is really a need to provide life-saving assistance. And this need is really alarming. The situation is really alarming.
More resources will be needed in the coming days to adequately respond to the crisis. Abibatu says that our efforts should be scaled up. IOM, she says, is appealing to the international community for more funds to help the refugees in the border town of Metemma.
So what we are doing for now, we have a migrant response center that is also overcrowded, where we are providing assistance, including temporary accommodation, wash, protection and health services, including also onward transport. This is what we are doing and looking at really at the needs of the population there, the most vulnerable one. And as we said, now as of now, we have recorded more than 35,000 people who have arrived in Metemma, and the majority of them being Ethiopian. We have recorded more than 66 nationalities, and for those CCN also, they need support. So meaning the accommodation, but be supported to return to their country of origin. And now this is what IAM is doing. And as I said, even the daily arrival, numbers of daily arrival and the number of people more and more vulnerable arriving, we really need to scale up. And this means that we need more resources to be able to provide the adequate responses for those people in need. So that's why we are now appealing. We have prepared an appeal that we have already published, so requiring 25 million in order already to be able to continue.
IOM Chief of Mission in Ethiopia, Abibatu Wayne Fall, points out the cooperation of the Ethiopian government regarding the crisis. She also says that Ethiopia's Beni Shangul zone bordering Sudan has now become a second entry point, and the assistance should be expanded to that area, she says. Overall, IOM's latest statistics show that at least 843,130 people across Sudan have been displaced, with nearly 259,000 fleeing to neighboring countries.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, more refugees escaped from Sudan. That story is coming up right after this break. You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Tigrayans who fled Ethiopia's civil war to neighboring Sudan say they are not receiving enough aid due to the outbreak of violence there, but they are afraid to return to Ethiopia because of alleged ethnic cleansing. Others resorting to desperate measures are falling victim to human trafficking, promising to help them find a passage to Europe. Henry Wilkins reports from N'Djamena, Chad.
Since Ethiopia's civil war started in 2020, neighbouring Sudan has received 70,000 Ethiopian refugees. Now, many find themselves caught up in the maelstrom of Sudan's civil war, which started on April 15th. An Ethiopian refugee in a camp near the Sudanese city of Gedaref, who asked to remain anonymous out of fear for his family's safety, told VOA by phone,
It seems like there is no medicine and there is a shortage of water and the food. Also, there is a high market price and there is no way also where the refugees can get money, even from family abroad, since the banks are not working.
He says this situation has persisted since Sudan's war started. Although Ethiopia's war has broadly come to an end thanks to a peace process started in November, Ethiopia's Tigray region is still far too dangerous for most refugees to return. On June 1st, Human Rights Watch said a campaign of ethnic cleansing against Tigrayans is ongoing despite the peace agreement. Before Sudan's conflict started, VOA spoke to Tigrayan refugees in Khartoum. They said they feared for the lives of their family members still inside Tigray. Asked if she had managed to escape to Sudan with all her children, Shamsia Ibrahim, an Ethiopian refugee, said this.
She says two of her children are still there, although four escaped with her. People have told her her son is living in Tigray, but she can't reach him by phone and doesn't know if he's okay or not.
A report by the British newspaper The Guardian on May 15th said Ethiopian refugees in Sudan are falling into the hands of human traffickers who promise passage to Europe. Some are even being kidnapped by them. Also speaking before Sudan's civil war broke out, another Tigray refugee, whose name we have changed to protect his safety. He is from the Ethiopian town of Himera. VOA visited Himera last year and heard testimonies of vicious bouts of ethnic cleansing. He says he tried paying traffickers to take him to Europe through Libya rather than stay in Sudan.
He says he and other refugees spent 2 weeks in a huge building like a warehouse. They were given water and 2 pieces of bread per day, but because there were no other buildings around it, there was nowhere to run to.
Having no money left, he was able to return to Khartoum. Aid groups say Ethiopian refugees in Sudan are caught between a rock and a hard place.
Will Carter is the Norwegian Refugee Council country director for Sudan.
For the people from Ethiopia, it's clear there was some progress in a peace accord, but there wasn't a process for returning people, that wasn't necessarily their immediate intention. Most of them did want to go back at some point, that's our understanding, but not the conditions weren't right, particularly in the places that they'd come from in western Tigray.
As fighting in Khartoum continues, some flow of aid into sites in Sudan occupied by Ethiopian refugees has resumed, after initially being halted entirely by the conflict. Henry Wilkins for VOA News, N'Djamena, Chad.
From Chad, we move to Juba in South Sudan. South Sudan's Minister for Justice, Ruben Madol Arol, says technical consultations have delayed the completion of the country's permanent constitution. As per the 2018 revitalized peace agreement, the constitution-making process was supposed to be completed within 24 months after the signing of the agreement. For VOA News, Wake Simon Wudu reports from Juba.
The new roadmap for the extension of the transitional period set July 2024 as the deadline for completing the drafting of the permanent constitution for South Sudan. A number of key activities outlined in the roadmap as part of the permanent constitution-making process, such as the reconstitution of the National Constitutional Review Commission, establishment of the Constitutional Drafting Committee, and the recruitment of members, are yet to be conducted. Robin Madol Arol, South Sudan's Minister of Justice and Constitutional Affairs, says the constitutional drafting exercise requires time.
There are other aspects of the agreement, like security arrangements, like transitional justice mechanisms, like institutional reforms, particularly in the justice sector, the security sector, and even in the economic sector. It's a vast area, and therefore it takes a lot of time in order to do the correct thing. Okay, first of all, understand where you are to start from. And there are so many stakeholders who are supposed to be actors in the implementation. These people got to be given room to play their role.
According to the timeline stipulated in the country's roadmap for extension of the transitional period, by June 2023, the Constitutional Drafting Committee should have published the second draft of the permanent constitution to solicit public opinions. Peter Lomude Francis, a member of South Sudan Opposition Alliance, OSOA, an umbrella group that signed the revitalized peace agreement, says lack of commitment from the parties has delayed the reconstitution of the National Constitutional Review Commission.
So the parties are not serious, really, in following the timeline that they even developed themselves in the roadmap, and also following the laws, because for the case of this, the law has specified very clearly that within 45 days from the day that the law is assented to by the president, the NCRC is supposed to be reconstituted in order for them to start to formulate their work plan and to start engaging in civic education and public consultation.
John Aganyi, a member of the SPLMIG and a lawmaker at the National Parliament, disagrees with Lomude and says the parties are trying to be careful in implementing the peace agreement.
So, in fact, our situation, my dear, is a very, very fragile situation. If we are not careful, it can bring us back to square one. So as to, for the people of South Sudan to gain momentum and let us also gain a responsibility of having a nation, let us move slowly so that we go to the promised land of peace. But this agreement is a very complicated agreement.
Policy analyst Lual Achwil Deng, who heads the Juba-based think tank Ebony Center for Strategic Studies, says the parties to the agreement have the chance of working out the permanent constitution in a period of 90 days.
All the necessary material is in place. What do I mean by that? We have the transitional constitution for South Sudan from which you can withdraw from. We have the peace agreement. We have the revitalized peace agreement. We have the resolution of the national dialogue. And various discussion the committee or the commission has been working on talking to individual.
Achwil says if the activities outlined in the roadmap, including a permanent constitution, are not completed on time, South Sudan could witness another crisis at the end of the current transitional period.
It can be chaotic. We have already seen what is happening in Khartoum. So some of my thinking would be really to let this government extend it RR access or the roadmap. Let them finish their period by February 2025 and put in place a real government of a real interim government of South Sudan.
General Charles Tai Gitwai, the chairperson of the body monitoring the implementation of the country's 2018 Revitalized Peace Agreement, said recently that the implementation of the peace deal is far behind schedule. Gitwai said there is no progress to report on the formation of the National Constitutional Review Commission and the establishment of the constitution-making bodies. For VOA News, I'm Wake Simon Wudu in Juba.
From Juba, we move to Bor in the Jonglei state capital. The state government in Jonglei has issued 2 weeks ultimatum to government employees to report to their place of work or face dismissal. The Jonglei state secretary general says some employees on government payrolls do not comply with the Civil Service Act of 2011, which requires government employees to report to work daily. Deng Gai Deng has details for VOA from Bor.
Some government employees say poor working conditions and salaries delays have forced some of them to look for alternative means of survival. Godwit Kok-Nguyen says the ultimatum is part of the government's efforts to eliminate ghost names on payrolls.
We cannot be generous enough to an extent of making people who don't show up in their workplace to receive salary that they don't deserve. I personally believe that those who never been reporting to the work for the last 10 months, maybe they are ghost name, maybe they are children's, maybe they are not.
Mike Garang works with the Jonglei State Ministry of Education. Garang says many of his colleagues have not been reporting to work. He says he is in Juba to look for additional sources of income so that he can feed his family.
This measure is not a solution according to the employee justice policy. But we need to first sit down and address issues that are affecting employees. You may dismiss one today, and tomorrow you're going to dismiss another employee. So how are you going to fill such vacuum? And the problem has not been solved. The issue of salary, which is very, very minimal, cannot really let someone to go to the market and sustain his life or her life.
Ruben Matiob is another government employee in Jonglei State. He says civil servants and some members of the state executive, including Governor Dine Jokchagur, spent most of their time out of their duty stations. Matiob alleges the order might be a concealed state government plan to misuse civil servants' salaries.
The decision taken by the government of Jonglei State is not fair. The work begins. It begins from the head of the state. Each and everybody must be in his office or her office. So if people are going to be restricted or weak, each and everybody must be in place of work. It will start from the top official. That's away from the governor, deputy governor, and all other stakeholders within the state.
Matiob says the state government employees receive meager salaries at the end of the month, adding he wonders why the state government want to punish its own workers who are struggling to survive during South Sudan's economic crisis. For VOA News, I am Deng Gai Deng in Bor.
From Bor, we move back to Juba, where the United Nations Population Fund and the South Sudan Boxing Federation have opened the first female boxing facility in Juba. For details, Juliana Shiapai reports from Juba.
South Sudan has 8 female boxers in the entire country due to parochial stereotypes associated with the game in South Sudan. Barbara Lam Palviano, a mother of 4, is a representative for the female boxers in South Sudan. Palviano enrolled in a Uganda boxing club in 2013. She says the new gymnasium in Juba comes handy.
Can start inviting other countries to also to come and perform in our country. So we have that strong heart now. Even me, I'm proud of myself to see other people coming in our country to perform because we have enough space for them.
Ressa Atiana Abdulbagi, chairlady of the South Sudan Boxers Federation, says the facility could motivate and attract women to join boxing clubs in the capital.
Our people of Republic of South Sudan think that boxing is for male, but I believe and I wanted to assure them boxing is for both female and men. Women can do even better than men. And this facility will benefit, and it is unique, and it is one of the best.
Ademola Olajide, the representative of the United Nations Population Fund in South Sudan, says participation of women and girls in sports could lead to social or economic transformation.
So this is not a one-off. We hear you about the needs that are still there. I'm glad my colleague from UNICEF is here, and we will continue to look for ways of providing the support till that point, where these girls not only become champions in the ring, but they become champions and advocates of social change within society.
Cecilia Kamis Malesh is a female boxer and a student at the University of Juba. She says boxing gives her confidence and motivation.
I really enjoy it. Like, it's a mental game, and so I learn a lot about it. So it's also one of defending games, so let me say to protect yourself. So boxing is very important, especially for us girls. Sometimes we have to do some stuff like to bring power or to do so many things, to encourage yourself up, not to give up on sometimes.
Officials from the UNFPA and the South Sudan Boxing Federation say they hope the new facility will help the female boxers to excel and attract more women to participate in the boxing across the country. For VOA News, I am Juliana Shiapai in Juba.
And that's all we prepared for you this Tuesday. I'm John Tanza in Washington on this live broadcast here in Washington. On behalf of our producer Kwame Ofori and engineer Akila Williams, we wish you